Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutan.
Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. On February 9th, police in Terengganu detained a 15-year-old rape victim for 7 days. This after her newborn baby boy was found dead with chest wounds. She has since been charged with murder, which carries the death penalty if convicted. Now, many social and political leaders have called out what they think are serious gaps in the conduct of a case involving two victims, the baby as well as the underage mother. What ought justice look like in this scenario, in this case? Our first guest tonight is family and child rights lawyer Goh Siew Lin. Siew Lin, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm just wondering what the case, this specific case, has highlighted to you about the gaps in the criminal justice system, particularly when we have children who are in conflict with the law.
Hi, Melissa. Hi, Sharon. Thanks for having me on the show. This case, I think, really highlights the tragedy of a child whose needs have not been met or addressed by the authorities and by all the stakeholders. So as you know, a child is below the age of 18. And just to give a bit of background on Malaysia's ratification to the Convention on the Rights of the Child. So that actually is an international treaty to which Malaysia has signed on to. What that means is many of the obligations, which is to promote child rights and uphold their status as rights holder, are now incorporated into the Child Act of 2001. So in this particular case, Malaysia actually has an obligation to protect all children, and that includes children in conflict with the law, from all forms of physical or mental violence. So what we need to also draw attention to is that what is the underlying cause that led to the commission of this crime? So this child actually wears many hats. One, as you said earlier, as a victim of a sexual crime, which is rape, statutory rape, and the other as the outcome of that rape leading to a pregnancy, infanticide. So on a domestic front, I just wanted to also say that Malaysia's international record in terms of guaranteeing children's rights to justice currently, and I checked the Child Rights International Network, Malaysia is ranked 130 out of 197 countries that have been surveyed. So we only score a very low score of 41.2%. Okay, so first of all, the legal framework, yes, it's not there.
Right, so I wanted to ask you about this, about the gap between what is legally required, our obligations under international law that we might have voluntarily signed on to, and the way in which institutions work. In this case, the police, the prison authorities, the AG's chambers, the hospitals, all of them which were implicated in this case, do they understand what these legal obligations that you speak of mean for their own practice and conduct?
That's a very good question. Based on how the case seems to pan out in the initial days, it doesn't appear to be so. So there seems to be a lack of awareness and understanding on the application of the Child Act, which can be read harmoniously with the Penal Code. So, and also there is a provision in the Child Act which says, and she actually holds the hat of a victim too, that the purpose, you cannot treat a child the same way that you treat an adult offender. So that's one big distinction. And also if we take it from the very early stage when she was first arrested and detained for investigation, there are a few questions that, you know, arise. Firstly, when she was first taken in, was the welfare department alerted by the police? Was there an SOP for an automatic alert of this child's situation to the JKM? So the JKM should have a supervisory and protective role over her. Secondly, as the protector of the child, was there a formal appointment of the JKM as a protector? Or if not, then the appointment of a fit and proper person over the child. It could be a relative, it could be the mother, okay, formally appointed. So what was, as I said, the originating crime? It all points out to the statutory rape. but the focus now seems to shift on the infanticide, you know, the death of the baby. So in this case, did the police
Sorry to interrupt, but you mentioned infanticide, and I just wanted to focus on that. While there has been a lot of attention on that, the charge seems to be one of murder as opposed to infanticide. Can you just quickly make the distinction for us?
Okay. So in the case of a murder, so there, first of all, the penalties are very different. Murder leads to a sentence of the death penalty, but because she's a child, this will be then translated to life imprisonment. Whereas infanticide, the maximum penalty under our laws is 20 years. But interestingly, in Singapore, the length of time for infanticide is 10 years, so it's much lower as an alternative to lifetime imprisonment. And there's also the fact of, under the Singapore equivalent of the provision, they take into account the emotional stress, whether the mother was lactating and all these other circumstances, which doesn't seem to be present in our provisions. So that the main distinction is the severity of the sentencing.
So, Suelin, you know, the Malaysian Medical Association expressed horror at what has happened in this case and, you know, made reference to postpartum depression. I think it's something that you alluded to. But the question is whether not just our courts take this into consideration as a defense, but whether, you know, all those institutions, the police, the AG's chambers, also recognize this as a real problem. Because at the end of the day, you know, aren't we trying to deliver justice, not just, you know, in terms of the murder, but in terms of what happened, as you say, in the originating, crime, which is rape.
Yes. So there are so many agencies involved. So I don't think we have like a holistic, coordinated, collaborative working relationship, because it seems from an outsider's view that it's quite disjointed. So the police and actually JKM should be the first responders to this child. And also when dealing with the child, is there training in how to deal with the child in terms of child-sensitive language, her age and understanding, immediate referral to medical and psychiatric or counselling support? So all this, there is a question mark there. So I also understand that the child was questioned, but was her parent there? Was she given information about the right to free representation? Because we have the Bar Council Legal Aid Centres in every state. We also have the YBGK, and all these legal aid services are provided free of charge to all children, regardless of race, nationality, and origin. So it's free. It's supposed to be free. And particularly in a sexual crime, the Sexual Offences Against Children Act have also provided, when you read in tandem with the Legal Aid Act, legal companions who are supposed to accompany the child throughout the process to provide that moral support all the way up to the end of trial. So this is a question mark. Who was with her when she was questioned? Then also, we have some information from news reports that she could possibly be a child with special needs, disabilities. So there was some mention of the child being given an OKU card. So was there a proper assessment of her ability to make decisions, her rational thinking? And then there is also much research, which I have read recently, that when you are under intense stress, and this is in the context of divorce and family separation, this, which is less traumatic than I think in her situation. So in that kind of situation, the research showed that a person's IQ actually drops by 30% generally. So I don't know, this child, how she was, what condition she was in, what was her mental state, what kind of assessment was done. I don't know whether there was even a written report, you know, and usually for such a very severe crime like this, a lot of care and attention and sensitivity is needed in the handling of this case.
Suelin, do you think that this case will trigger some kind of change or improvement? I mean, you know, I wonder whether there's been a lot of attention or thought being put into the way the juvenile justice, the system works with juvenile justice, whether there's been, or whether it's an afterthought. And I'm just wondering whether things might improve after this?
I hope so. I hope that this creates enough groundswell and political will, and you know the urgency to make change. Because right now I can see that usually children and women's issues are not prioritized. You know, and at the end of the day, there is this wonderful quote by the special rapporteur on judges and lawyers. Because when the administration of justice fails children, it ultimately also fails society. So we need to invest in child-sensitive justice, which is indispensable to strengthening the rule of law and enjoyment of human rights by all. So in the context of children in conflict with the law, there's also the concept of diversion, you know? So that means you don't push the child through the criminal justice system. The whole aim and goal is to rehabilitate and reintegrate the child into society. So our country actually is the only one in ASEAN that has not had a diversion program. The US has had it for 20 years, UK, but we have only, I mean, there was reports that it was launched, you know, a pilot project in 2019 by the former Minister of Women. And what it does is to have a trained group of a team of JKM officers and all that to rehabilitate and to counsel these children. Singapore's diversion program.
Right, yes. Right. So, Suila, in the minute that we have left, I mean, the fact that she's now been charged with murder, you know, what does it reflect? Does it reflect in any way the values of our system and the values that are in our institutions? Are we a deeply patriarchal, paternalistic, moralistic, system of governance, which militates against precisely the kinds of things you're talking about, the ability to rehabilitate children, bring them back into the fold, recognize the injustice done to them, and therefore, you know, seek to find a kind of middle road to justice rather than throw the book at this child, as it seems to be done now?
I agree with you, actually. So I feel that Malaysians can do better. Malaysia deserves better. And I'm sure all the child rights and bodies are very happy to work together with the government and officers to create a better system for all children. We want to breathe life into the Child Act. We want the children to come to court without handcuffs. These are all provided in the Act. No handcuffs, to be kept separate from prisoners, to be informed of the grounds of the arrest, to be walked through the journey of court, to have our national laws, the convention and all the acts synchronized, you know, to have parity in sentencing. So there's no uncertainty. And then what are the clear guidelines say, for instance, before a trial is going to start, some ground rules as to what is ethical cross-examination of children. What about children with vulnerabilities, disabled? And then hard facilities like child rooms, child witness rooms, lifelink facilities, training. Actually, the soft skills are the most important. Training and sensitization of all the stakeholders, frontliners, police, JKM, lawyers, prosecutors, judiciary, and most of all, legislators, because we need them to bring everything in line so that we can really help our children through this very hostile legal process. Yeah, so I'm optimistic that we must all go work towards that.
Thank you so much, Siew Lin, for joining us on the show tonight. Founding child rights lawyer, Go Siew Lin. We're going to take a quick break here on Consider This. We will be back with more. Stay tuned. Hi, thanks so much for staying with Sharad and I on Consider This. We're discussing the detention and charge of a 15-year-old rape victim who allegedly stabbed her newborn baby boy, which was conceived through rape. Joining us on the show right now, we have Melissa Muhammad Ahir. She's currently an access to justice consultant with Kamban Collective. Previously, she was with the Attorney General's Chambers as a federal counsel and deputy public prosecutor for almost 10 years. Melissa, let's look at this case. It's really highlighted to some people. In fact, some groups have called for a rethink of the system, for the way authorities handle or investigate cases which in which children are in conflict with the law or are involved in. Can we talk a little bit about your observations? What struck you the most about this case?
Thank you for that question. What struck me the most basically is on three different aspects and three different points. If we were to read all the various news reports, it appears that many areas where children's rights, where they do have their human rights, whether as a child in conflict with the law, or in this case, as per the allegations, whether the girl in question is a child in need of protection, especially in terms of how she had probably has a learning disability, or probably is within the facts, seems to have been unable to prevent herself from causing harm, whether to herself or to another. So in those circumstances, and even more concerningly, number three, even as an alleged rape victim. So for all these three areas, there doesn't seem to have been an implementation or observation of human rights in all those aspects, whether the rights that comes from Malaysian laws or written in the guidelines or SOPs, many, many areas seem to be missing. And there is a very, very large concern whether now she is in conditions that could amount to torture even.
Melissa, do you think that, and this is a weird question maybe to somebody who's from a legal background, but do you think that our system lacks compassion, that it doesn't in fact understand what it means to deal differently between adults and children, and that within children who, you know, who are in many ways, you know, acting in very adult ways, right? Having a sexual life or in relationships and such. Do you think our system, our criminal justice system, just can't understand that and therefore lacks compassion and wants to throw the book at them?
Yeah, so to provide a bit of nuance or a bit of layer, I'm a bit conflicted regarding the question that you're asking, because we do have in writing many aspects of the laws that do have certain consideration of vulnerabilities. If a person has disabilities, if a person is actually victimized by another crime, there are many areas within our laws that can be put into action by the agencies and can become part of our attitude or norms or culture. There is a lot of space for it. However, in terms of what is actually being done is where I'm torn, in where we do not even try and approach it from the start as this is a child. The facts show that she is below 18 years old. So a child giving birth to a child, and that child who has given birth may also have suffered from disabilities. So when we say OKU and you can get an OKU card, means you are in vulnerable circumstances, and we keep on going to the punitive approaches from the start, even before a crime has been proven. So from all these approaches, I think you are hinting at a lack of compassion or a lack of looking at the circumstances of this particular child, but also of other children in general, but also within all the layers of the rights that applies to Malaysia. So in terms of gender, as a female, secondly, as a child, thirdly, as a person with disabilities. And incidentally, these are all three areas of where Malaysia has promised in the eyes of the world that we will observe the rights of. And it doesn't seem to appear so. So perhaps we need to relook at things. Why are we stuck within the punitive viewpoints throughout the stages of our systems?
Melissa, can I get you to elaborate a little bit on that, particularly because when we spoke to Siew Lin before this, she mentioned a diversion program. And I'm just wondering, maybe you can help us understand what are the alternatives to criminalization and detention for young offenders, children in conflict with the law?
Yeah, so especially from the outset, because our own laws say that number one is the care, number one is the protection, and number one is the rehabilitation of children. So we have to look at their environment, we have to look at their surroundings, we have to prioritize their survival and development because they reflect us as a society. So within the systems, from the start, if we can get the approaches where not everyone, especially children with vulnerabilities, are not thrown into prison, we can try and use the discretion of looking at community-based approaches. So there's many ways in which an investigation can go ahead, the proceedings in court can go ahead, and there's no risk of absconding, for example, with this child, because she has disabilities and vulnerabilities and serious psychiatric health concerns, probably, if she's examined fully. So from this, we can divert to use all the multidisciplinary systems that we have and avoid detention, because detention doesn't solve any issue. And even more so in this case, there is still a lot of gray areas. There is still a lot of reports or evidence that we still need to look at. So we need to look at the circumstances, how social welfare department comes into play, how even child protectors come into play. So
So, right. In terms of your, you know, personal experience in this field, what is the likely scenario? You just painted, what if we were more compassionate, we could do such and such. But what is likely to happen to this young woman? What is the most likely scenario, you know, over the next 20 years for her life?
So I'll start with only what we know from the news reports, just the conditions. Before that, you were going through pregnancy. Would you have suffered through post-traumatic stress disorder or postpartum depression? In a situation, in case you have depression, you are further imprisoned. And then if you're further imprisoned, even if they call it at the pleasure of the Yang di-Pertuan Agong, if she is convicted, then in those situations, what happens to her development and even for her growth? So that suffering is why I used the word torture just now. In terms of layers and layers of oppression she might have gone through, we would not be able to determine. I mean, I'm very taken by what the Malaysian Medical Association said, how risk-taking behavior or how much damaging or harmful impact it would have on the girl. So to give you a short answer, I would really like to read all of the psychiatrist's report, or the I hope she is given access to all of these medical experts to be able to tell us how much she is suffering and how much she would suffer further if she's convicted and imprisoned further. There must be urgent action now.
All right. Melissa, if I may just very quickly read out the MMA statement. Why was this girl who was a rape victim not offered the proper psychological support throughout her pregnancy? What horrors and stress she must have accompanied this young girl throughout pregnancy to make her commit infanticide on the day the child was born? That's a statement from the MMA. I do want to follow up a question about something that Siew Lin alerted us to earlier about training and sensitization, and whether there is a will or a drive for capacity building within law enforcement, within the criminal justice system, to handle cases like this. As you say, an intersection between a child and a woman, a female, and someone with likely a disability.
Yeah, most definitely. There's a good point by Siew Lin, because within trainings, from my experience alone, and I don't think things have changed, before you become an officer or staff, most likely human rights education is not part of the compulsory content of the curriculum. There is no requirement for you to know all those three areas you just mentioned to be able to do your job effectively. So basically, the government must emphasize this. The government must ensure that the humans, the personnel running the system, would respect human rights and the dignity of a child. However, by saying that there are many shining lights despite this lack of education, despite this lack of training, capacity building, who have tried to support children as best as they could. But I think we need to invest further to ensure all of the working conditions, all of the practices become a norm that human rights is respected, especially in terms of a child with all three layers of those oppressive conditions or discrimination. So for this, there must be compulsory human rights education in a practical manner for them to know from the start, when she was pregnant, up to the arrest and up to the charging in court. And even now, at all stages, it's respected and it's applied so that they, the child is not basically punished before even the conviction is comes into place. And the liberty must be respected always and not as a last resort, or being no compassion or having the punitive approach is not the first resort, which is the reality that we are seeing now. So this is a crucial investment. We must do this now, the training of all the officers concerned.
Melissa, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. That was Melissa Mohammad Ahir, and she's currently an Access to Justice consultant with Kemban Collective. Thank you so much. That's all we have for you on this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutan, signing off for the evening.
Thank you so much for watching, and good night.